Chapter 14. How to Interest Your Audience. There is in all communication, written or spoken, a certain deadline of interest. If we can cross that deadline, we have the world with us, temporarily at least. If we cannot cross it, we may as well retire. The world will have none of us. H. A. Overstreet. From Influencing Human Behavior. Always have something to say. The man who has something to say and who is known never to speak unless he has is sure to be listened to. Always know before what you mean to say. If your mind is muddled, much more will the minds of your bearers be confused. Always arrange your thoughts in some sort of order, no matter how brief they are to be. They will be better for having a beginning, a middle, and an end. At all hazards, be clear. Make your meaning, whatever it is, plain to your audience. In controversial speaking, aim to anticipate your adversary's argument. Reply to his jests seriously, and to his earnestness by jest. Always reflect beforehand upon the kind of audience you are likely to have. Never, if you can help it, be dull. Lord Bryce. If you had been invited to dine at the home of a rich man in certain sections of the old Chinese Empire, it would be proper to toss chicken bones and olive seeds over your shoulder onto the floor. You pay your host a compliment when you did that. You show that you realize that he is wealthy, that he has plenty of servants to tidy up after the meal, and he likes it. You can be reckless with the remains of your sumptuous meal in a rich man's home, but in some parts of China, the poorer people might save even the water they bathe in. To heat water costs so much that they must buy it at a hot water shop. After they have bathed in it, they can take it back and sell it secondhand to the shopkeeper from whom they purchased it. When the second customer has soiled it, the water still retains a market value, although the price has softened a bit. Have you found these facts about Chinese life interesting? If so, do you know why? Because those are very unusual aspects of very usual things. They are strange truths about such commonplace events as dining out and bathing. That is what interests us. Something new about the old. Let us take another illustration. Say you were reading this now, this sheet of paper you are looking at. It is very ordinary, isn't it? You have seen countless thousands of pages. It seems dull and insipid now, but if I tell you a strange fact about it, you are almost sure to be interested. Let us see. This page seems like solid matter as you look at it now, but in reality it is more like a cobweb than solid matter. The physicist knows it is composed of atoms. And how small is an atom? There are as many atoms in one drop of water as there are drops of water in the Mediterranean Sea. There are as many atoms in one drop of water as there are blades of grass in all the world. And the atoms that make this paper are composed of what? Still smaller things called electrons and protons. These electrons are all rotating around the central proton of the atom, as far from it, relatively speaking, as the moon is from the Earth. And they are swinging through their orbits, these electrons of this tiny universe, at the inconceivable speed of approximately 10,000 miles a second. So, the electrons that compose this sheet of paper you are holding have moved, since you began reading this very sentence, a distance equal to that which stretches between New York and Tokyo. And only 2 minutes ago, you may have thought this piece of paper was still and dull and dead. But in reality, it is one of God's mysteries. It is a veritable cyclone of energy. If you are interested in it now, it's because you have learned a new and strange fact about it. There lies one of the secrets of interesting people. That is a significant truth, one that we ought to profit by in our everyday intercourse. The entirely new is not interesting. The entirely old has no attractiveness for us. We want to be told something new about the old. You cannot, for example, interest an Illinois farmer with a description of the cathedral at Bourges or the Mona Lisa. They are too new to him. There is no tie-up to his old interests. But you can interest him by relating the fact that farmers in Holland till land below the level of the sea and dig ditches to act as fences and build bridges to serve as gates. Your Illinois farmer will listen open-mouthed while you tell him that Dutch farmers keep the cows, during the winter, under the same roof that houses the family, and sometimes the cows look out through face curtains at driving snows. He knows about cows and fences. New slants, you see, on old things. "Lace curtains for a cow?" he'll exclaim. "I'll be doggoned." And he will retell that story to his friends. Here's a talk delivered by a New York City student of my course. As you listen to it, see if it interests you. If it does, do you know why? How sulfuric acid affects you. Most liquids are measured by the pint, quart, gallon, or barrel. We ordinarily speak of quarts of wine, gallons of milk, and barrels of molasses. When a new oil gusher is discovered, we speak of its output as so many barrels per day. There is one liquid, however, that is manufactured and consumed in such large quantities that the unit of measurement employed is the ton. This liquid is sulfuric acid. It touches you in your daily life in a score of ways. If it were not for sulfuric acid, your car would stop, and you would go back to old Dobbin and the buggy, for it is used extensively in the refining of kerosene and gasoline. The electric lights that illuminate your office, that shine upon your dinner table, that show you the way to bed at night, would not be possible without it. When you get up in the morning and turn on the water for your bath, you use a nickel-plated faucet, which requires sulfuric acid in its manufacture. It was required also in the finishing of your enameled tub. The soap you use has possibly been made from greases or oils that have been treated with the acid. Your towel has made its acquaintance before you made the acquaintance of your towel. The bristles in your hairbrush have required it, and your plastic comb could not have been produced without it. Your razor, no doubt, has been pickled in it after annealing. You put on your underwear. You button up your outer garments. The bleacher, the manufacturer of dyes, and the dyer himself used it. The button maker possibly found the acid necessary to complete your buttons. The tanner used sulfuric acid in making the leather for your shoes, and it serves us again when we wish to polish them. You come down to breakfast. The cup and saucer, if they were other than plain white, would not have come into being without it. It is used to produce the gilt and other ornamental colorings. Your spoon, knife, and fork have seen a bath of sulfuric acid, if they are silver-plated. The wheat of which your bread or rolls are made has probably been grown by the use of a phosphate fertilizer, whose manufacture rests upon this acid. If you have buckwheat cakes and syrup, your syrup needed it. And so on through the whole day. Its work affects you at every turn. Go where you will, you cannot escape its influence. We can neither go to war without it, nor live in peace without it. So it hardly seems possible that this acid, so essential to mankind, should be totally unfamiliar to the average person. But such is the case. The three most interesting things in the world. What would you say they are, the three most interesting subjects in the world? Sex, property, and religion. By the first, we can create life. By the second, we can maintain it. By the third, we hope to continue it in the world to come. But it is our sex, our property, our religion that interests us. Our interests swarm about our own egos. We are not interested in a talk on how to make wills in Peru. But we may be interested in a talk entitled, How to Make Our Wills. We are not interested, except perhaps out of curiosity, in the religions of the people in India. But we are vitally interested in a religion that ensures us unending happiness in the world to come. When the Lord Northcliffe was asked what interests people, he answered with one word, and that word was themselves. Northcliffe ought to have known, for he was the wealthiest newspaper owner in Great Britain. Do you want to know what kind of a person you are? Oh, now we are on an interesting topic. We are talking about you. Here is a way for you to hold the mirror up to your real self and see you as you really are. Watch your reveries. What do we mean by reveries? James Harvey Robinson answered this in his book titled The Mind in the Making. He wrote, "We all appear to ourselves to be thinking all the time during our waking hours, and most of us are aware that we go on thinking while we are asleep, even more foolishly than when awake. When uninterrupted by some practical issue, we are engaged in what is now known as a reverie. This is our spontaneous and favorite kind of thinking. We allow our ideas to take their own course, and this course is determined by our hopes and fears, our spontaneous desires, their fulfillment or frustration, by our likes and dislikes, our loves and hates and resentments. There is nothing else anything like so interesting to ourselves as ourselves. All thought that is not more or less laboriously controlled and directed will inevitably circle about the beloved ego." It is amusing and pathetic to observe this tendency in ourselves and in others. We learn politely and generously to overlook this truth. But if we dare to think of it, it blazes forth like the noontide sun. Our reveries form the chief index of our fundamental character. They are a reflection of our nature, as modified by often hidden and forgotten experiences. The reverie doubtless influences all our speculations in its persistent tendency to self-magnification and self-justification, which are its chief preoccupations. So remember that the people you are to talk to spend most of their time when they are not concerned with the problems of business in thinking about and justifying and glorifying themselves. Remember that most of us are more concerned about the cook leaving than about Italy paying her debts to the United States. We are more wrought up over a dull razor blade than over a revolution in South America. Our own toothache will distress us more than an earthquake in Asia destroying 500,000 lives. Most of us would rather listen to someone say something nice about us than hear that person discuss the 10 greatest people in history. How to be a good conversationalist. The reason so many people are poor conversationalists is because they talk about only the things that interest them. That may be deadly boring to others. Reverse the process. Lead the other person into talking about her interests, his business, her hobbies, his golf score, or her children. Do that, and listen intently, and you will give pleasure. Consequently, you will be considered a good conversationalist, even though you have done very little of the talking. One of my students made an extraordinarily successful speech at a banquet that marked the final session of my public speaking course. He talked about each person in turn around the entire table, commented on how that person had talked when the course started, how he or she had improved, recalled the talks various members had made, the subjects they had discussed. He mimicked some of them, exaggerated their peculiarities, had everyone laughing, had everyone pleased. With such material, he could not possibly have failed. It was absolutely ideal. No other topic under the blue dome of heaven would have so interested that group. An idea that won 2 million readers. Some years ago, the American magazine enjoyed an amazing growth. Its sudden leap in circulation became one of the sensations of the publishing world. The secret? The secret was its editor, John M. Sydall, and his ideas. When I first met Sydall, he had charge of the Interesting People department of that periodical. I had written a few articles for him, and one day he sat down and talked to me for a long time. "People are selfish," he said. "They are interested chiefly in themselves. They are not very much concerned about whether the government should own the railroads, but they do want to know how to get ahead, how to draw more salary, how to keep healthy. If I were editor of this magazine," he went on, "I would tell them how to take care of their teeth, how to take baths, How to keep cool in summer, how to get a position, how to handle employees, how to buy homes, how to remember, how to avoid grammatical errors, and so on. People are always interested in human stories, so I would have some rich man tell how he made $1 million in real estate. I would get prominent bankers and presidents of various corporations to tell the stories of how they battled their ways up from the ranks to power and wealth. Shortly after that, Seidel was made editor. The magazine then had a small circulation, was comparatively a failure. Seidel did just what he said he would do. The response? It was overwhelming. The circulation figures climbed up to 200,000. 3, 4, 500,000. Here was something the public wanted. Soon, 1 million people a month were buying it, then 1.5 million, finally 2 millions. Seidel appealed to the selfish interests of his readers. How Dr. Conwell interested millions of hearers. What was the secret of the most popular lecture of its time, titled Acres of Diamonds? Just the thing we have been talking about. John M. Seidel discussed this lecture in the conversation I have just referred to, and I think that its enormous success had something to do with determining the policy of his magazine. It tells people how they can get ahead, how they can make more out of themselves in their present environment. It was never a static lecture. Dr. Conwell made it personal to each town where he spoke. It was of immense importance. The local references made it appear fresh and new. They made that town, that audience, seem important. Here is his own story of how he did it. He said, "I visit a town or city and try to arrive there early enough to see the postmaster, the barber, the keeper of the hotel, the principal of the schools, and the ministers of some of the churches, and then go into some of the factories and stores and talk with the people and get into sympathy with the local conditions of that town or city and see what has been their history, what opportunities they had, and what they had failed to do. And every town fails to do something. And then go to the lecture and talk to those people about the subjects which apply to their locality." Acres of Diamonds, the idea, has continuously been precisely the same. The idea is that in this country of ours, all of us have the opportunity to make more of ourselves than we do in our own environment, with our own skill, with our own energy, and with our own friends. The kind of speech material that always holds attention. You may possibly bore people if you talk about things and ideas, but you can hardly fail to hold their attention when you talk about people. Tomorrow there will be millions of conversations floating over fences in the backyards of America, over tea tables and dinner tables, and what will be the predominating note in most of them? Personalities. "He said this. Mrs. So-and-so did that. I saw her do this, that, and the other. He is making a killing," and so on. I have addressed many gatherings of school children in the United States and Canada, and I soon learned by experience that in order to keep them interested, I had to tell them stories about people. As soon as I became general and dwelt with abstract ideas, Susie became restless and wiggled in her seat. Tommy made a face at someone. Billy threw something across the aisle. True, these were audiences of children, but the adults are just as likely to get restless when a talk becomes boring. So one can hardly go wrong in making a generous use of human interest stories. Our magazines that are read by millions and the most popular radio and television programs are filled with them. I once asked a group of American business executives in Paris to talk on how to succeed. Most of them praised the homely virtues, preached at, lectured to, and bored their hearers. So I halted this class and said something like this: "We don't want to be lectured to. No one enjoys that. Remember, you must be entertaining, or we will pay no attention whatever to what you are saying. Also remember that one of the most interesting things in the world is sublimated, glorified gossip. So tell us the stories of two people you have known. Tell why one succeeded and why the other failed. We will gladly listen to that, remember it, and possibly profit by it. It will also, by the way, be far easier for you to deliver than are these wordy, abstract preachments. There was a certain member of that course who invariably found it difficult to interest either himself or his audience. This night, however, he seized the human story suggestion and told us of two of his classmates in college. One of them had been so conservative that he had bought shirts at the different stores in town, made charts showing which ones laundered best, wore longest, and gave the most service per dollar invested. His mind was always on pennies, yet when he graduated, it was an engineering college. He had such a high opinion of his own importance that he was not willing to begin at the bottom and work his way up, as the other graduates were doing. Even when the third annual reunion of the class came, he was still making laundry charts of his shirts while waiting for some extraordinarily good thing to come his way. It never came. A quarter of a century has passed since then, and this man, dissatisfied and soured on life, still holds a minor position. The speaker then contrasted with this failure the story of one of his classmates who had surpassed all expectations. This particular chap was a good mixer. Everyone liked him. Although he was ambitious to do big things later, he started as a draftsman. But he was always on the lookout for opportunity. Plans were then being made for the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo. He knew engineering talent would be needed there, so he resigned from his position in Philadelphia and moved to Buffalo. Through his agreeable personality, he soon won the friendship of a Buffalo man with considerable political influence. The two formed a partnership and engaged immediately in the contracting business. They did considerable work for the telephone company, and this man was finally taken over by that concern at a large salary. Today, he is a multimillionaire, one of the principal owners of his company. We have recorded here only the bare outline of what the speaker told. He made his talk interesting and illuminating with a score of amusing and human details. He talked on and on, this man who could not ordinarily find material for a 3-minute speech, and he was surprised beyond words to learn when he stopped that he had held the floor on this occasion for half an hour. The speech had been so interesting that it seemed short to everyone. It was this student's first real triumph. Almost every student can profit by this incident. The average speech would be far more appealing if it were rich and replete with human interest stories. The speaker ought to attempt to make only a few points and to illustrate them with concrete cases. Such a method of speech building can hardly fail to get and hold attention. If possible, these stories ought to tell of struggles, of things fought for and victories won. All of us are tremendously interested in fights and combats. There is an old saying that all the world loves a lover. It doesn't. What all the world loves is a scrap. It wants to see two lovers struggling for the hand of one woman. As an illustration of this fact, read almost any novel, magazine story, or go to see almost any film drama. When all the obstacles are removed, and the reputed hero takes the so-called heroine in his arms, the audience begins reaching for their hats and coats. Almost all romance fiction is based on this formula. Make the reader like the hero or heroine. Make him or her long for something intensely. Make that something seem impossible to get. Show how the hero or heroine fights and gets it. The story of how a person battled in business or profession or for a just or unpopular political cause against discouraging odds and won is always inspiring, always interesting. A magazine editor once told me that the real inside story of any person's life is entertaining. If one has struggled and fought, and who hasn't, that story, if correctly told, will appeal. There can be no doubt of it. Be concrete. The writer once had in the same course in public speaking a doctor of philosophy and a rough-and-ready fellow who had spent his youth 30 years ago in the British Navy. The polished scholar was a university professor. His classmate from the Seven Seas was the proprietor of a small side-street moving van establishment. Strange to say, The moving van man's talks during the course would have held a popular audience far better than the talks of the college professor. Why? The college man spoke in beautiful English, with a demeanor of culture and refinement, and with logic and clearness, but his talks lacked one essential ingredient: concreteness. They were too vague, too general. On the other hand, the van owner possessed hardly enough brain power to generalize. When he talked, he got right down to business immediately. He was definite. He was concrete. That quality, coupled with his virility and his fresh phraseology, made his talks very entertaining. I have cited this instance, not because it is typical either of university professors or moving van proprietors, but because it illustrates the interest-getting power that accrues to the individual, regardless of education, who has the happy habit of being concrete and definite in speaking. This principle is so important that we are going to use several illustrations to try to lodge it firmly in your mind. We hope you will never forget it. Never neglect it. Is it, for example, more interesting to state that Martin Luther, as a boy, was stubborn and intractable? Or is it better to say that he confessed that his teachers had flogged him as often as 15 times in a forenoon? Words like stubborn and intractable have very little attention value. But isn't it easy to listen to the flogging count? The old method of writing a biography was to deal in a lot of generalities, which Aristotle called, and rightly called, the refuge of weak minds. The new method is to deal with concrete facts that speak for themselves. The old-fashioned biographer said that John Doe was born of poor but honest parents. The new method would say that John Doe's father couldn't afford a pair of overshoes, so when the snow came, he had to tie gunny sacks around his shoes to keep his feet dry and warm. But in spite of his poverty, he never watered the milk, and he always gave full value when selling his crops. And that shows that his parents were poor but honest, doesn't it? And doesn't it do it in a way that is far more interesting than the poor but honest method? If this method works for modern biographers, it will work also for modern speakers. Let us take one more illustration. Suppose you wish to state that the potential horsepower wasted at Niagara every day was appalling. Suppose you said just that, and then added that if it were utilized and the resulting profits turned to purchasing the necessities of life, crowds could be clothed and fed. Would that be the way to make it interesting and entertaining? No. Isn't this far better? Now, we're quoting from an article in the Daily Science News Bulletin. We are told that there are some millions of people in poverty and poorly nourished in this country, yet here at Niagara is wasted the equivalent of 250,000 loaves of bread an hour. We may see with our mind's eye 600,000 nice, fresh eggs dropping over the precipice every hour and making a gigantic omelet in the whirlpool. If cloth were continuously pouring from the looms in a stream 4,000 feet wide, like Niagara River, it would represent the same destruction of property. If a Carnegie Library were held under the spout, it would be filled with good books in an hour or two. Or we can imagine a big department store floating down from Lake Erie every day and smashing its very contents on the rocks 160 feet below. That would be an exceedingly interesting and diverting spectacle, quite as attractive to the crowd as the present, and no more expensive to maintain. Yet some people might object to that on the ground of extravagance, who now object to the utilization of the power of the falling water. Picture-building words. In this process of interest-getting, there is one aid, one technique that is of the highest importance, yet it is all but ignored. The average speaker does not seem to be aware of its existence. He or she has probably never consciously thought about it at all. I refer to the process of using words that create pictures. The speaker who is easy to listen to is the one who sets images floating before your eyes. The one who employs foggy, commonplace, colorless symbols sets the audience to nodding. Pictures. Pictures, pictures. They are as free as the air you breathe. Sprinkle them through your talks, your conversation, and you will be more entertaining, more influential. To illustrate, Let us take the excerpt just quoted from the Daily Science News Bulletin regarding Niagara. Did you hear those picture words? They leap up and go scampering away in every sentence, as thick as rabbits in Australia. 25,000 loaves of bread. 600,000 eggs dropping over the precipice. Gigantic omelet in the whirlpool. Cloth pouring from the looms in a stream 4,000 feet wide. Carnegie Library held under the spout. Books. A big department store floating. Smashing. Rocks below. Falling water. It would be almost as difficult to ignore such a talk or article as it would be to pay not the slightest attention to the scenes from a film unwinding on the silver screen of the motion picture theater. Herbert Spencer, in his famous little essay on the philosophy of style, pointed out long ago the superiority of terms that call forth bright pictures. He wrote, "We do not think," he says, "in generals, but in particulars. We should avoid such a sentence as, in proportion as the manners, customs, and amusements of a nation are cruel and barbarous, the regulations of their penal code will be severe." And in place of it, we should write, "In proportion as people delight in battles, bullfights, and combats of gladiators, will they punish by hanging, burning, and the rack." Picture-building phrases swarm through the pages of the Bible and through Shakespeare like bees around a cider mill. For example, a commonplace writer would have said that a certain thing would be superfluous, like trying to improve the perfect. How did Shakespeare express the same thought? With a picture phrase that is immortal. "To gild refined gold, to paint the lily, to throw perfume on the violet." Did you ever pause to observe that the proverbs that are passed on from generation to generation are almost all visual sayings? "A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush." "It never rains, but it pours." "You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink." And you will find the same picture element in almost all the similes that have lived for centuries and grown hoary with too much use, such as "sly as a fox," "dead as a doornail," "flat as a pancake," and "hard as a rock." Lincoln continually talked in visual terminology. When he became annoyed with the long, complicated red tape reports that came to his desk in the White House, he objected to them, not with a colorless phraseology, but with a picture phrase that is almost impossible to forget. "When I send a man to buy a horse," he said, "I don't want to be told how many hairs the horse has in its tail. I wish only to know his points." Successful people use word pictures. Audrey L. sells computers. In discussing problems faced by one of her prospects, she learned that he was primarily concerned with the messy office he supervised. "Papers and files are all over the place," he complained, "and I can never find the files I need. They're always out, probably in one of those piles." After describing the technical aspects of her company's product, she said, "Let's look ahead to 6 months from now. You walk into your office. There are no piles of papers on desks or chairs. Your people are working at their computers. You need a file? You sit down at a terminal and key in the file name. Instantly, the information desired appears on your screen. No waiting, no frustration." Audrey has drawn a word picture of the future. The manager does not require much imagination to visualize this and recognize the value of making the purchase. It works for salespeople, and it will work for you when making a speech. The interest-getting value of contrasts. Listen to the following condemnation of King Charles I by the British historian Thomas Babington Macaulay. Note that Macaulay not only uses pictures, but he also employs balanced sentences. "Violent contrasts almost always hold our interests." "Violent contrasts are the very brick and mortar of this paragraph." He wrote, "We charge him with having broken his coronation oath, and we are told that he kept his marriage vow. We accuse him of having given up his people to the merciless inflections of the most hot-headed of prelates, and the defense is that he took his little son on his knee and kissed him. We censure him for having violated the articles of the Petition of Right, after having, for good and valuable consideration, promised to observe them. And we are informed that he was accustomed to hear prayers at 6 o'clock in the morning. It is to such considerations as these, together with his Van Dyke dress, his handsome face, and his peaked beard, that he owes, we verily believe, most of his popularity with the present generation. Interest is contagious. We have been discussing so far the kind of material that interests an audience. However one might mechanically follow all the suggestions made here, and yet be vapid and dull. Catching and holding the interest of people is a delicate thing, a matter of feeling and spirit. It is not like operating a steam engine. No book of precise rules can be given for it. Interest, be it remembered, is contagious. Your hearers are almost sure to catch it if you have a bad case of it yourself. A short time ago, a gentleman rose during a session of my course in Baltimore and warned his audience that if the present methods of catching rockfish in the Chesapeake Bay were continued, the species would become extinct. And in a very few years, he felt his subject. It was important. He was in real earnest about it. Everything about his matter and manner showed that. When he arose to speak, I did not know that there was such an animal as a rockfish in the Chesapeake Bay. I imagine that most of the audience shared my lack of knowledge and lack of interest. But before the speaker finished, all of us had caught something of his concern. All of us would probably have been willing to sign a petition to the legislature to protect the rockfish by law. I once asked Richard Washburn Child, the American ambassador to Italy, the secret of his success as an interesting writer. He replied, "I am so excited about life that I cannot keep still. I just have to tell people about it." One cannot keep from being enthralled with a speaker or writer like that. I recently went to hear a speaker in London. After he was through, one of our party remarked that he enjoyed the last part of the talk far more than the first. When I asked him why, he replied, "The speaker himself seemed to be more interested in the last part, and I always rely on the speaker to supply the enthusiasm and interest." Everyone does. Remember that. In a nutshell, 1. We are interested in extraordinary facts about ordinary things. 2. Our chief interest is ourselves. 3. The person who leads others to talk about themselves and their interests and listens intently will generally be considered a good conversationalist, even though he does very little talking. 4. Glorified gossip, stories of people, will almost always win and hold attention. The speaker ought to make only a few points and to illustrate them with human interest stories. 5. Be concrete and definite. Do not belong to the poor but honest school of speakers. Do not merely say that Martin Luther was stubborn and intractable as a boy. Announce that fact, then follow it with the assertion that his teachers flogged him as often as 15 times in a forenoon. That makes the general assertion clear, impressive, and interesting. 6. Sprinkle your talks with phrases that create pictures, with words that set images floating before your eyes. 7. If possible, use balanced sentences and contrasting ideas. And finally, 8. Interest is contagious. The audience is sure to catch it if the speaker has a bad case of it. But it cannot be won by the mechanical adherence to mere rules. Errors in English. Review. There are 3 errors in the following paragraph. Can you locate them? "Was this done by you or who?" was the shout exploded at us as we came through the door. It was a question of whether he or myself should take the blame. He don't feel that the fault was his, and I feel that it was not mine. New study material. Rule. Words joined to the subject by such expressions as with, together with, as well as, in addition to, do not pluralize the subject and do not cause the subject to require a plural verb. For example, "The task of getting proper machinery, with that of raising capital and of employing experienced workers, was enormous." Here's a wrong example. The task of getting proper machinery, with that of raising capital and of employing experienced workers, were enormous. Here's a right example. The invoice mailed yesterday, in addition to the bills due last month, has been paid. And here's a wrong example. The invoice mailed yesterday, in addition to the bills due last month, have been paid. Right? Major Harvey, as well as Colonel Mills, has appraised the property. Wrong. Major Harvey, as well as Colonel Mills, have appraised the property. Right. Our entire factory, with all of its contents, together with three adjoining storerooms, was burned yesterday. Wrong. Our entire factory, with all of its contents, together with three adjoining storerooms, were burned yesterday. Rule. Do not use the double negative. Note the examples that follow. Correct. I can hardly see. Incorrect. I can't hardly see. Correct. I never cause any harm to anyone. Incorrect. I never cause no harm to nobody. Rule. Do not use never to take the place of not. Examples of this are as follows. Right? I did not bring my notebook to take dictation. Wrong. I never brought my notebook to take dictation. Rule. In certain sections of the country, especially, it is customary to misuse yet, already, once, and however. Here's a correct example. The letter is still here. Incorrect. The letter is here yet. Correct. He has gone already. And incorrect. He has gone already yet. Rule. At the beginning of a sentence, do not use such introductory words as why, well, then, now, see, and again, unless they are needed. They are very often used because the speaker has gotten into such a habit. Effective speaking, both in public and in conversation, is often marred by this habit. Some contracted forms cause trouble in speaking. The most important of these are don't, doesn't, hain't, and ain't. Don't is a contraction of do not, and therefore should be used with plural subjects, and with the word I. You may say I don't, we don't, you don't, they don't, and don't with any other plural subject, but you should never say he don't, she don't, and it don't. Examples? Correct. He does not care for the theater. Incorrect. He don't care for the theater. Haint is a provincialism and is used very extensively in certain sections of the United States. If possible, it is more erroneous than ain't. Both of these expressions are improper contractions for are not, aren't, have not, haven't, has not, hasn't, is not, and isn't. Here's a correct example. Isn't he here? And incorrect. Ain't he here? A correct example. Haven't you got it? And incorrect. Haint or ain't you got it? Correct usage of words. Bent, bias, inclination, and prepossession. These words agree in describing a permanent influence upon the mind that tends to decide its actions. Bent denotes a fixed tendency of the mind in a given direction. It is the widest of these terms and applies to the will, the intellect, and the affections taken conjointly. As, the whole bent of his character was toward evil practices. Bias is literally a weight fixed on one side of a ball used in bowling and causing it to swerve from a straight course. Used figuratively, bias applies particularly to the judgment and denotes something that acts with a permanent force on the character through that faculty, as the bias of early education, early habits, etc. Inclination is an excited state of desire or appetency, as a strong inclination to study the law, Prepossession is a mingled state of feeling and opinion in respect to some person or subject that has taken hold of and occupied the mind previous to inquiry. The word is commonly used in a good sense, an unfavorable impression of this kind being denominated by the word prejudice. Strong minds will be strongly bent and usually labor under a strong bias. But there is no mind so weak and powerless as not to have its inclinations, and none so guarded to be without its prepossessions. Here I'm quoting from Crabb and the Webster's International Dictionary. Enormous, immense, and excessive. Enormous means out of due proportion, beyond the normal. A prize fighter has enormous strength. Immense denotes a very large quantity, a vast extent. Excessive means beyond what is just, and always denotes something evil. The Queen Elizabeth II is an enormous ship sailing across an immense expanse of sea. If a person of moderate means were obliged to pay one for its deluxe suites, he or she would undoubtedly consider the price enormous or excessive. Voice exercise. How to be heard at a distance. It is not necessary to shout and yell in order to make yourself heard in a large hall or out of doors. It is necessary only to use your voice correctly. A whisper, if reinforced by the right tone conditions, will carry to the farthest corner of the largest theater. Usually, a public address system will be available in large rooms or auditoriums. How to use such systems effectively was discussed in Chapter 5. If there is no public address system, or you choose not to use it, here are some suggestions that will aid you in being heard. 1. Do not gaze at the floor. That is amateurish. It's annoying to an audience. It destroys a sense of communication, a feeling of give and take between the listeners and talker. It also directs the tone down toward the floor and interferes with its floating out over the audience. 2. The breath, said Madame Schumann-Heinck, is the motive power of voice. Without it under intelligent control, nothing can be accomplished. One might as well try to run an automobile without gasoline as to sing without breath. Yes, or to speak without it. It is the powder behind the bullets of your words. There should be, at all times, a reserve of breath in your lungs to act as a springboard, a catapult to launch your words. You have doubtlessly seen, in store windows or in shooting galleries, little balls dancing up and down on jets of water. Your words should be buoyed up by breath like that. They should ride like a kite on a cushion of air. So, breathe deeply, feeling the lower part of the lungs expanding at the lower ribs and pushing down and flattening out the arched diaphragm. When you start to speak, do not use up all your breath at once. Use as little as possible. Control it according to the directions given in Chapter 5. 3. Relax the throat, the lips, the jaw. Go back and review Chapters 4, 9, and 10 to go over those specific exercises. Constricted tones will not carry because they have little vibration. 4. Pounding with a hammer on a piece of iron will make a disagreeable noise which is all but deafening close at hand, but it will not carry. But the music of an orchestra or a band can be heard playing for a long distance through a racket and uproar. Why the difference? That is easy to explain. The instruments of the band make pure harmonious sounds, sounds with resonance. But the hammer striking the iron makes only a dull, ugly clangor without resonance. Only a few days ago, the author stood beside a bugler sounding a call. Had the bugler used the same amount of breath in a harsh shout, it would not have carried very far. But his breath, sent into the bugle, vibrating in its resonance chambers, created sound waves which carried a long, long distance. Now we can understand why some voices that seem very loud to those in the front rows do not carry far. They lack resonance, and it is resonance that makes a sound carry, resonance and openness, and breath reserve. So practice often the voice exercises given for this purpose in Chapters 4, 9, and 10. As you are listening to the radio, hum the tunes that are playing. Feel with your open palm the vibrations on the top and back of your head, in the nose, on the lips, in the cheeks, in the chest. To make the most of your natural resonance, speak with the same open sensation in your head that you have when you are drinking in the air. This is most important. 5. Sound your vowels distinctly. They are the very heart of your words. It is the vibration of the vowel sounds that carries. Consequently, they must not be neglected or slighted. They must be spoken with freedom and openness and accuracy. Here are the most commonly used vowel sounds. Practice them aloud now. Mate, mote, mute, moot, rack, wreck, rick, rock, ruck, rook, baa, and boil. As you say them, relax and drop the jaw. Now say them again, using them this time as an exercise for flexibility of the lips. The correct use of the lips is all important in the sounding of the vowels. The following are sometimes called small vowels. They express delicacy. The lips should be stuck out almost into a pout as they are pronounced. Try them now. We have connected these vowel sounds with the letter N to give them a singing quality. N, as in men. Ain, as in drain. Een, as in seen. In, as in sin. Here are the bright vowels, expressing joy, sunshine, and gladness. Say them with the lips drawn back into something like a smiling position. An, as in can. Ein, as in line. On, as in ah. Now, these are the heavy vowels, expressing strength, sonority, richness, fullness, and depth. Say them with the lips a little more open than in the whistling position. Chin relaxed, dropped, and very loose. On, as in on. Own, as in o. Oon, as in boon. And own, as in own. 6. The pitch of your voice ought to vary, ought to flow up and down the scale, naturally and spontaneously as you speak. This principle of delivery was discussed in Chapter 7. This change of pitch will help you to individualize your words, to make them more distinctive. And finally, 7. In order to be heard at a distance, we need volume. Do not confuse this with mere loudness. One who does not mean what one says and has slight interest in it will not, other things being equal, be heard as far as one who puts his or her heart and soul and sincerity into the talk. It is not emptiness that carries, it is richness. One of the first things that the physician notices on entering the sick room is the voice. It reflects one's vitality. A robust voice with carrying power does not come from a sick or even tired body. So rest before you speak. Obey the laws of sensible living. A beautiful voice, beautifully used, can only continue to come from a healthy body. Robust health is essential to any large measure of success. Plenty of fresh air, simple nourishing food, and 8 or 9 hours of sleep are all necessary to the singer or speaker whose larynx invariably reflects his or her bodily conditions.